We will find out what to avoid in a financial planner and much more during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our regular On Your Money expert, Kevin McKinley, is off today, but never fear, we have great financial advice coming your way from the nationally renowned personal finance expert, Jane Bryant Quinn. We'll talk about a wide variety of money matters during the show, from whether you can trust your financial planner to reasons to invest in bonds to why a reverse mortgage could be right for you, even if you don't need the money. Plus, we'll start off with some practical ways to save money, even if you're on a tight budget. And we hope you will share your money-saving ideas, too. How do you feed the pig, so to speak? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. We welcome your money-saving tips, but we also welcome your personal finance questions for Jane Bryant Quinn. You can also email us on your money at WPR.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let me welcome our guest, Jane Bryant Quinn, personal finance writer, co-founder of DailyVoice.com. She's the author of Making the Most of Your Money Now, and she writes the monthly Financially Speaking column for the AARP Bulletin. Thank you so much for being with us, Jane. I know we asked you at the very last minute, and we really appreciate it.
I'm happy to be with you always, Joy. I like talking to you, and I like talking to your audience.
Yes, and we love having you. We did originally have a guest on who was going to just give us some practical, everyday money-saving tips, everything from just save your loose change. Maybe do you have some general advice if we just want to sock away some money, do a better job perhaps saving money even if we are on a tight budget? What would you recommend?
I have certainly gone through the save a loose change business myself. For my kids, it was always save birthday money. If you're with a business that pays a year-end bonus, you don't spend the bonus in advance, you save the bonus. If you don't spend your next raise, if you get a raise, that's another way of doing it. There are, personally, I have a property tax bill once a year, and all of a sudden it arrives at the end of the year, and I look at it and say, ugh. But what I do is over the month, over the year, I set aside on my, I have a little calendar because I run everything on my computer, as I think a lot of people do these days. And once a month it comes up on my little calendar, put X dollars into your savings account so that you can pay the tax bill at the end of the year. And I found that to be very useful because the thing sits there and stares at me, and if I haven't put in the money, I finally get tired of it and put it in.
So generally speaking, how would you say Americans do at saving money? Are we better at it than we used to be?
Well, we are not as good at it as we were 20 years ago, but if you look at how we were doing in 09 and 10 and 11, our savings rate is actually up a little. You know, there's a kind of trade-off here, Joy, because obviously younger people need to save, and they realize more and more they have to, but they're very squeezed. At the same time, older people are dis-saving. You know, there are more and more boomers retiring, and they're starting to draw on the money that they saved over the years. So when you look at the savings rate, it is lower than it used to be, it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, we're all a wreck about saving, because older people are pulling out of that pool while younger people are putting into it. But I absolutely would encourage anybody working who is lucky enough to have a 401k or a thrift savings plan or some such thing at work to put the money in, because any money that is taken out of your paycheck in advance that you don't see, that is money you will save. It's just astonishing how much people can save when they don't see the money in the bank. It's the only actual mystery in personal finance. Mm-hmm. The only magic is that if it's not in your paycheck and it's not in the bank and you don't see it, you won't spend it. And this is what these 401k plans are for. And if you don't have one, your bank will have an individual retirement account. You can set that up. You can have the money moved automatically, and you won't see it in your bank account.
Well, looking at a study or a survey, 40% of us had an emergency fund in 2012, and that's up from 35% in 2009. But it means that half of us do not have emergency savings. How much of a rainy day fund should we have?
You know, Joy, that depends to me on how much consumer debt you have on your credit card.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could say, oh, well, you know, you need 3 months rainy day fund or 6 months rainy day fund. You know, everybody has a different number, but it's usually somewhere in the 3 months to 12 months range, which is just something you say, right? I mean, who knows? But if you've got money in your savings that's earning approximately zero right now and minus zero after taxes and inflation, and then you've got a credit card bill of, you know, 19.6%, and you're not putting that savings into your paying off your credit card debt, I mean, that's just crazy.
Mm-hmm.
The return that you get for paying off a debt equals the interest rate you pay. So if you've got 19.6% debt on your credit card and you put money into repaying that, you have earned 19.6% on the money you put in to repay that debt. And this is the highest percentage return you are going to get anywhere, guaranteed. So, I mean, it's nice to have a small cash fund. Yes, I'm in favor of that, and I think you should build it up after you get rid of your consumer debt.
Makes sense.
That's the thing that's killing you if you're carrying it.
That makes sense. That same study from the National Financial Capability Study shows that 34% of Americans pay only the minimum amount due on their credit cards. That's down from 40% in 2009, so it's better. Half of us, or 49% of us, are able to pay off our credit card balance in full each month. How do you suggest we use our credit cards so that we can pay this debt off?
Well, one way people are doing it themselves is that they're, instead of using credit cards, they're using debit cards.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a very smart way of helping to, you know, maintain your spending carefully, because you only have so much money in the bank. Yeah, you've put some of it into a 401k, right?
Right.
What's left in your bank is what you've got, and if you're using a debit card, not a credit card, you basically can't overspend it. I suppose you can go a little over, but I hope not, because you get a big fee if you do. But you can't overspend it. And that's one way that I think that's one of the reasons that you see so many more people controlling their spending, is just using the debit cards. Some people get their pay on pay cards, and so the card is basically all they have. That's another very good way of controlling spending. On the credit card side, you know, if that's your weakness, we talk about goals in this wonderful America Saves program, and you start out saying, what is my goal for this year? What is my goal for this month? Anybody who's carrying credit card debt, that should be their goal. You should start working on a system to pay that off. I mean, you bought a sweater, 5 years ago, and you're still paying for it. And you're still paying interest on it because you're paying the minimum on your card. Now, when you get into a squeeze, it's a blessing that you can do that because it helps you. But your absolute main goal should be not to use that credit card for more stuff, to get out of that terrible situation you're in.
I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Jane Bryant Quinn, personal finance expert, author of many books, including Making the Most of Your Money Now. She also writes the monthly Financially Speaking column for the AARP. We welcome your personal finance questions for her. your questions about money matters of all kinds at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. We'll be talking about a wide variety of financial issues as we go along during this edition of On Your Money, but starting off with some practical everyday things that we can do to save money. And we welcome your suggestions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Jane Branquin, we will branch out, but I wondered, you know, let's say you just want to save a little bit of money or at the grocery store or on the energy bill or different areas of our lives so you can better budget, so you can pay off that credit card debt or whatever else. Are you a big fan of, for example, buying in bulk?
I buy in bulk things that I know aren't going to spoil. I've got in my basement, I think I have enough toilet paper and paper towels for the next 3 months or maybe six. So I am a fan of buying in bulk under those circumstances. I'm also a fan of doing such things as being careful to take out more than you need in your tax, basically, so that you get a tax refund every year. I mean, that's a pretty painless way of saving, and I know people will say, oh, you shouldn't do that, you should have the money, you should put it in the bank, but let's face it, a little bit of money on each paycheck you're not going to put in the bank, and if it's effectively being saved for you by the government and then you get a tax refund, that's a piece of cash that you can then put into a savings account or put toward put towards some kind of debt reduction. And you know, Joy, this is something about 3 months ago. I pay the bills in the family for my sins, and so I was going through them saying, you know, I haven't looked at these bills for a while. You know, you get the result and you go click, 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 and you pay them because, you know, that's what you do. And I started going over things like my phone bills and my cable bills and this and that, and I said, I'm on a tear to see what I'm paying that I don't really have to. I called up my phone provider and we went down everything point by point by point, and I saved $50 a month on my phone bill just taking stuff off, some of which I didn't even realize was on. So I kind of called it vacuum cleaning my bills. I was, you know, pulling up all of the stuff in these regular bills that I just had not paid as much attention to as I should. So there's a little thing. And my husband shops with coupons. He does the grocery shopping. I pay the bills. He does the cooking and the grocery shopping, and he takes coupons.
All right. So using coupons, as long as you're using the coupons for things you'd buy anyway.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, yeah. What about packing your lunch rather than going to the restaurant, or skipping the latte, or just going for the plain Java?
Do you know, this whole business is a latte factor. Mm-hmm. They're saying, oh, you go for the latte and you pay whatever you pay, you know, $2.50. I don't know what you pay. But let's say $2 because it's nice and round. You say, okay, I'm not going to pay $2. I'm going to have plain Java. And the plain Java is going to cost me $1. But the plain Java is actually not very good, and I don't like it very much. And so, you know, the latte factor is kind of a little thing. But, and so, I don't know, I save $1 a day and, you know, not on weekends or whatever it is, and maybe I've got $300. But, you know, that's not the big thing, Joy. I mean, there are a lot of little things, but if regular Java makes you miserable and latte makes you happy, you know, that is a small thing. A much bigger thing is when you walk through the mall because it's on your way home, mm-hmm. and you buy something you see in the window, that's a big thing. And you can deal with that by saying, I'm not going to go home that way. I'm going to go home some different way. So I'm not going to be tempted by going into the mall and buying that sweater. So I'm not big on saying you can solve all your problems by switching to cheaper coffee, but I am big on saying look at your daily habits, where you walk, what you do, what tempts you, and how you can maybe change your behavior so you won't be tempted by that.
Good advice. We will continue talking with Jane Bryant Quinn. She is author of Making the Most of Your Money Now. About personal finance issues, we will ask her about what to avoid in a financial planner, and we'll get some reasons to invest in bonds, and we'll find out why a reverse mortgage may be right for you even if you don't need the money. And we welcome your questions for Jane Bryant Quinn at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
The coins in the fountain, each one seeking happiness.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, our regular financial planner. Kevin McKinley is off today. Very happy to have with us nationally renowned personal finance expert Jane Bryant Quinn. She is here to share information and advice on your money and answer your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tom in Kenosha is with us first. Hello, Tom. You're on the air.
Hello. Hello. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, Tom.
Jane. My question, I have a $13,000 balance on my home equity loan, and right now the interest rate on it is something like 4.3. Now, I also have enough money in the bank and my savings that I could just go ahead and pay that off, but I'm able to deduct the interest on my taxes at the end of the year, so I'm just wondering, should I just pay it off now, because I'm not getting any interest on my savings, so I just pay it off, or is it smarter to pay it a month at a time and then get that break on taxes, that tax break?
Oh, Tom, pay it off, pay it off. You know, you're not saving 100% of what you pay by taking the tax deduction. I mean, I don't know what bracket you're in, but, you know, if you're in, I don't know, 30% bracket, 30% of that money is savings, and the other 70% you're taking of the interest, the other 70% comes right straight out of your own pocket. So, you know, I think this whole business of, quote, you need a tax deduction, which has been, you know, applied to home mortgages, credit lines, and all this thing over the years, is one of the most astonishing pieces of propaganda that banks and lenders have successfully been able to do for the American public. You don't need a tax deduction. That tax deduction is going to be small relative to the total amount of interest you pay. And all it does is help the bank collect more interest. Assuming that you can pay this off and it doesn't otherwise impinge on or affect your standard of living, absolutely pay it off. Nobody needs a tax deduction on their home equity or anything else. It's something you get because you've got a loan and it's nice to have and it helps a little bit. But if you don't, if you have the money not to have that loan, by all means, pay it off.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much. Thanks for the call, Tom. So the argument that sometimes you might have, if it's a mortgage that's really low interest, given the historically low interest rates, and paying it off would make things tight for you or drain your emergency fund, Jane Bryant Quinn, does that matter?
Yes, and that's what I've been, in speaking to Tom, I was just thinking of that. As long as paying off this home equity line doesn't, you know, doesn't otherwise affect or hurt his standard of living, he should definitely be paying it off. But if you're squeezed, if it's very hard for you to be making all these payments, then it's a blessing that the interest rate is low right now on mortgages and home equity lines. The question that really Tom posed that I hear so often from people is, well, shouldn't I have a tax deduction? Don't I need the tax deduction? The answer is no. But if you, if you have some money and you've got a, 3% mortgage rate, which is just astonishingly marvelous these days, 4%, and then you've got a credit card debt, I mean, pay the credit card debt for sure.
Well, you wrote a piece on your website recently about reverse mortgages, and the advice was take out a reverse mortgage even if we don't need the money, especially if we don't need the money. First, explain what a reverse mortgage is.
A reverse mortgage is something that you are eligible for at if you're a homeowner and you are age 62 or older. And it's a special program that helps people take equity out of their homes to help provide themselves with an income, presumably after they retire. And so you get a loan against your home equity, but you never have to pay it off as long as you are in the home. So you've got the money, and you can use it, and interest obviously builds up on it. It compounds when the house is eventually sold. When you leave the house, you sell it, you go into a nursing home, you die, whatever. When you leave the house, then the house is sold, the reverse mortgage is paid off, and if there's anything left over, you get it. If you're alive, your heirs get it. And if the loan at that point is larger than what the house is worth, then the bank or rather the Federal Housing Administration, which insures these loans, takes the loss. So the idea is that you're able to tap the equity in your home without having to make monthly payments as you would if you took a regular mortgage on your home, and that's why it's called a reverse mortgage.
And why would we take out a reverse mortgage if we really aren't pressed for money?
Well, here's the thing, and this is kind of new to me because I've always felt and written that a reverse mortgage is for something you should take in your late 70s, early 80s, if you're really running short of money and you don't want to sell your house and you want to stay there. It's kind of as a last resort. However, with interest rates so low these days, something else has come up. You can get a reverse mortgage without taking the cash out. You put the whole thing on a credit line. So there's an upfront fee you're going to pay for this, and now you've got a credit line. And this is a credit line that you can draw on anytime you want. You don't have to take it now. You can take it 5 years from now, 10 years from now, whenever. But the point about the credit line, these are called the reverse mortgages. They're called standard or saver mortgages, two types. The thing is that the credit line increases every year. That's the way these loans are set up. And so when you take a credit line at a time of low interest rates, when they still are low on the mortgages, you can get a much higher credit line than you could when interest rates are high. And then this credit line increases every year. So you've got it. You don't use it. It sits there. But 10 or 15 years from now, the credit line could be worth two or three times what it is now. And so then if inflation has come or you've run out of money, you're older, then you suddenly look at your credit line and you have this huge borrowing power, which hasn't cost you anything other than the upfront fee you pay. And it's a way of securing future borrowing power for yourself, and it's a way of managing your money. Maybe you take a little from the credit line because you want to leave money in your IRA right now. You know, there's a hole in your individual retirement account. You don't want to withdraw from that. You take from the credit line instead. So there's a whole way of managing this credit line attached to reverse mortgages, which is come up because interest rates are so low. And that is what I wrote about on my website, and there's more detail there, but it's something that obviously I think people should think about.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Jane Bryant Quinn. personal finance expert. Our number, if you have a question for her, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Katie in Mineral Point is with us now. Hello, Katie. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is, I'm getting married in the fall, and at the same time, my grace period is ending for paying back my grad school student loans, and we are trying to figure out whether we should file our taxes together jointly or if I should file separately. And the difference is if we file together, we'd have to pay back the full monthly payment for the loan repayment plan. But if we filed separately, I could do an income-based loan repayment plan since I'm a social worker, and that would, monthly payment would be much lower. So I guess we're trying to weigh our options between the lower monthly payment or any tax benefits we'd receive as a married couple.
First, congratulations on getting married. That's a very exciting time. This is a numbers answer because you have to, I don't think this is something that I can advise you one way or another because the answer lies absolutely in the numbers. You do your tax returns both ways and you see which deal is better for you. I would say one thing that if your incomes together are sufficient that you can get your student loans paid off sooner rather than later. I mean, if you take the income-based repayment, that means you're going to repay, obviously, much less every month. And so this stretches your loan out further and increases the long-term the amount of interest you're going to pay. So if it's possible for you as a couple to pay your get those loans paid off faster, I would suggest that you do that. You will find when you look at the tax rates for married people filing separately that they are much higher than you thought. So once you do those numbers and look at the tax gain that you will presumably get from filing jointly against the filing separately, that may make up your mind right there. But unfortunately, I am condemning you to doing two tax returns this year. But that is the only way you are actually going to find that out.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Katie, and congratulations. It's wonderful. Let's go next to Sandy in Janesville. Hello, Sandy. What's your question?
Hi. I'd like to know if you have to have your house paid off in full before you can apply for a reverse mortgage. And also, where do you go to get this reverse mortgage? Do you get it from the original lender?
First, you do not have to have the house paid off in full. The money that you borrow on your house can be as in a reverse loan. Can be used to repay the mortgage that you have now, and then you can put the rest into, obviously you can put the rest in the bank and start spending it, but I'm not advising that because I think you want to have some home equity going forward as you get older. But you can put the rest in the credit line, which would be my suggestion, and let that credit line sit there. And if for reverse mortgages, you can ask any lender if they are in the reverse mortgage business. You can go on search. You will find reverse mortgage advertised all over in your area. People that are, brokers that specialize in reverse mortgages. One of the things that the government did when it had this reverse mortgage plan is that it requires that you go through a counseling with the reverse mortgage because they were afraid that some older people might be taken advantage of or might be getting reverse mortgages and using up all their home equity too early and, or maybe people who didn't really need reverse mortgages, so what was the point? So there's a counseling program that will also help you, but the lender will direct you to that. So I would just start with your bank. I would start with a search engine, putting in Madison or Kenosha or wherever you are. And you'll find a reverse mortgage lender. It will be easy.
Okay. Can I ask one other quick question about the application? You said that there's a fee. Could you give us like a ballpark picture or figure of what that would be?
I'm not sure that I can, because it's going to depend on the size of your reverse mortgage. And the fee is larger than it would be if you took out a regular mortgage with the closing costs and all that kind of thing. I've felt that the upfront fees were, and by the way, the fee is rolled into the loan, so you don't have to have the cash. I have felt that the, if you were doing what I've suggested and taking the credit line and just letting it sit there and grow for the future to give you this borrowing power that you could have in the future, which I just think is a wonderful thing since the future is unknown. We live long, mm-hmm. and who knows what inflation will be. But if you, the price that you pay for that, I, as a kind of insurance policy for the future, I think is small, but it is certainly larger than you would pay if you took a regular mortgage.
Thank you very much, Sandy, for the call. Someone else with a question about reverse mortgages, Jim in Green Bay. Hi, Jim.
Yes, I'm an attorney, and I have set up several reverse mortgages in an alternative fashion, and I wanted to get her opinion on the subject, where a family came to me finding that a desirable financial plan to have a reverse mortgage, and they had children, let's say, for example, in their 40s who were financially well off, were bankrolling money, and conservative investors just putting their money in the bank at 1 or 1.5%, less than that today. And I would set up the reverse mortgage within the family and leave the institutional lender out of the process, setting it up with the children funding it. And they, of course, get the same mortgage on the house and the same note and so on and so forth, so that it's all legally documented. It seems to me to improve the total financial picture of that family, understandably in limited fact situations. But it did work out well, and I'd like her opinion on the subject. I'll take my answer off the air.
I think that's a perfectly good thing to do when you have a family of substantial means and the children of substantial means, and you all get along. You know, there could be some issues if one member of the family, one of the children, all of a sudden has a divorce, has a financial problem, doesn't want to be on the note. I mean, I have no idea how all of this was set up. It does require continuing good family relations. And so that's important to think about. They have to be able to, you know, keep the money available to the parents who have given them they've given the parents the reverse mortgage, and the parents have to be able to count on getting the money if they need it. So these are all interfamily issues. Financially, for a well-off family, that can work very well. I would just say that it depends a lot on the family dynamics and how they would handle some future surprise in any of the children's situations.
I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Jane Bryant Quinn, personal finance writer, co-founder of DailyVoice.com. She is the author of Making the Most of Your Money Now and writes the monthly Financially Speaking column for the AARP Bulletin. And she is our special guest during this edition of On Your Money. If you have a personal finance question for her, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. And we have an open line for you. You can also email us onyourmoney@wpr.org. Coming up, we'll talk about what to avoid in a financial planner, and we'll also talk about some reasons to invest in bonds. And of course, Jane will answer your questions too, whatever they may be. Our regular guest, certified financial planner Kevin McKinley, will be back next week. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Give me some money. Give me some money.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Jane Bryant Quinn about your money. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org if you have a personal finance question for her. Well, my question for you, Jane, is, should I trust my financial advisor, and how do I know if I should trust him or her or not?
This is finding someone you can trust is the biggest problem that, that I can think of in personal finance when you're looking for somebody to help you. I have always favored advisors who are fee-only, as they describe themselves, a fee-only advisor. That means the advisor charges you hourly for information or charges you a flat fee for a project. Or if you have money that you want managed by somebody else and you want the advisor to manage it, they charge a fixed percentage, preferably under 1%, to manage your money for you. And you know what the fee is. What I worry about all the time are the advisors who also sell products, because then there is no way you can be getting any kind of independent advice. And I don't care if they're, I mean, they're lovely people, they're friendly, they're helpful, they're as good as they can be. They might be your brother for all I know. But the only way they make money is by selling you a financial product. And they make more money if they sell you a financial product that has higher commissions than if it has lower commissions. So they will sell you the mutual funds that their own firm puts out, which are more expensive. They will love to sell you the most expensive income withdrawal annuity on the block, 3.5% or more in charges, some of which you probably don't even realize. And if you're paying 3.5% a year and you know what the market and bonds have been doing, how are you ever going to make anything on that? So there are some very expensive products that are sold, and that's what they do for a living, and that's okay. It's just that what you need to do for a living is try to avoid getting yourself into that situation and see if you can find a fee-only planner instead.
Yeah, it was my understanding that fee-only planners are few and far between?
They are not easily available, and that's another problem that it certainly is there for the average person. There's something called the Garrett Planning Network, where you can find fee-only planners if they're around somewhere. I'm sure there'll be lots in Madison. There are the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors. These are fee-only planners. The Financial Planning Association has both fee-only, and they also have commission planners, but you can, if you call it up on your website, you can click the box that says fee-only. And, you know, there's something else, and that is that there are people who can help you with basic budgeting, and there are websites where you can go on and say, you know, what if you're an investor, what's a good way of, allocating my assets. There are accountants can help you with basic budgeting if you're having trouble with that, or taxes. So it's not only an advisor there. And also, the big no-load mutual funds, Vanguard, Fidelity, T. Rowe Price, they have a lot of very good advisory services if you are an investor in their mutual funds. So there are ways of finding help that does not involve somebody selling you products. And I'm not saying they can't give you good advice. I'm saying the only way they can make you money is by giving you advice that has a big commission in it. Yeah. And that's expensive. By the way, here's one thing. Do I interrupt? Am I going on too long?
No. Finish your thought. That's fine.
A fascinating thing I discovered when I was writing about this, and this is the risk you have actually with many advisors. They say, okay, this advisor is going to have a conflict of interest, and she's going to want to sell you an annuity with a big fee. Mm-hmm. And so the answer to this is disclosure, so that you will know. Well, some studies have been done about consumer disclosure, and it turns out that if it is disclosed to you that it's a big fee, you are more apt to accept that than less. And the reason you are more apt to is that we are all so polite. And we somehow think, well, we don't want to contradict the advisor, and here she has gone to all this trouble, and she's laid out all of the costs. And I don't want to say, oh, I don't want to pay that. And even though I think it might not be so good, studies consistently show that with disclosure on these things, people are less apt to contradict the advisor and more apt to go along with it. So this is the weirdest behavioral thing in the world. But I think we can all recognize it. You know, somebody says something you don't like, but you're very polite and you smile and
yeah.
you say yes.
Isn't that something? Yeah.
Turns out that disclosing high fees is almost intimidating to people, and they don't want to be rude and turn it down.
Let's go to Joe in Johnson Creek. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I just wanted to offer up a little bit of advice based on a bad experience I had. When picking these financial advisors, regardless of how comfortable you are with them and how much you like what they're saying, before you actually bite the bullet and retire, make sure you take their plan and go get a second or third opinion on it. And you know, without that, you just don't know. And in my case, it was too late. I'm back working again because of that.
Oh, so that's too bad. So your financial planner said you have plenty of money to retire or whatever, and you didn't, Joe.
Oh, it wasn't just that. I mean, I can't even begin to get into everything he did wrong. I mean, he's
well, actually,
not in jail yet. But
second opinion, a good idea, Jane?
Yeah, well, and it, you know, if you go on one of these websites like the Garrett Planning Network or you know, Financial Planners Association and look for fee-only planners, several names will come up. And you will, so you have an opportunity to go and visit more than one of these planners and sort of get a sense, look at what they've done, try to get recommendations from other people. I don't know, Joe, was this a, were these commission planners? Were they charging commission?
Yes, yeah, they were.
Yeah, that's a problem. I'm sorry, that's a problem. And unfortunately, those are the planners that are most available to us, which is why you really have to make every possible effort to try to find a fee-only planner. By the way, one thing, the planners who pay commissions, who usually call themselves financial advisors or consultants or something like that, they don't call themselves brokers anymore. They are, because people are looking for fee-only financial planners, that is definitely the thing in the world. Consumers have caught on and they're looking for fee-only planners. A lot of these planners who use commissions are calling themselves fee-based planners, which can be a little confusing. You think, oh, good, Jane said I should get someone who charges fees. Here's a fee-based planner. A fee-based planner may have some services that he or she performs for fees, but also sells commissioned products to you. So the fee-based is a little deceptive if you see that.
Oh, so they'll get a fee based on my assets and their advice, but then they'll also get a commission.
But they'll sell you annuities
yeah.
that cost you 3.5% and you don't realize it. Yes, exactly.
All right, Joe, thanks for the advice.
I'm sorry Lynn, about that, Joe.
Yeah. Lynn in Colfax is with us now. Hello, Lynn.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question really is I'm 76 and I have no idea if I should be renting or buying a new house. I have to sell my old house, or I really should, because it's far, far, far too big for me that I'm alone now. And it's an older house and there's a lot of upkeep which I cannot do. Now, I've looked into the price of, you know, selling the house and then renting another house, and I pay far more for renting than my present mortgage. I've got about $60,000 left on the mortgage, and I don't want to take out a new one for 15 years. I probably won't even live that long. And I'm really wondering what I should be doing. Should I just stay in this great big house and pay someone to come in and fix it up? Should I get an apartment? I don't really want an apartment. Rent a house or buy something?
Well, if it were me, I would certainly not keep the big house. A house is a money pit, as you know and as I know and as every homeowner knows. And if it's big and you have to have somebody come in and take care of it, you know, and obviously you're past the sense of the sentimental part of it, you know, I will never leave this house, because you're looking at options. Personally, if it were me, I would sell it. I think if it were also me, I would look for, I know you don't want an apartment, I might, but the value, virtue of something like an apartment is that it can be very, very easy to take care of, because if you've got a landlord, it looks like a condominium or that kind of an apartment. It's so simple, and even if you buy a new house, you're still going to have upkeep and, you know, clean the drains and, you know, and keep the leaves out of the drains and mow the lawn and whatever repairs are going to have to be made on the house when you rent or buy it. But I would say that this would depend on your cash flow, because the advantage of renting is that, okay, you pay more per month than you're paying now, but you also have now in the bank or in your investments all of the equity that you got out of your house. So this greatly improves your cash flow, and you can look at having, you know, larger checks or more money to spend every month because you've got that money available in the bank. So my sense of whether to buy or to rent would come down to, if you bought again, first, how much are you going to have to put into the house to bring it up to your standards, and then do you have enough money so that you're only 76, you know. My mother is 97, and she just got married, so you got to consider. Life is very long, so you have to look at how much you have on the side to help pay all of your bills for the next 20 years. So that's the kind of trade-off that you're looking at. You're looking at the cost of and the upkeep and the repairs or whatever would have to be done if you bought the house, and versus if you rented. And then if you bought, how much extra money you would have in the bank to help pay your bills for 20 years compared with if you rented.
Lynn, something to think about, and live long, be happy. And Jane, wow, congratulations to your mom for getting married at 97.
This is a love match. My mother she's been a widow for 10 years. She met this lovely man who was 86 in the, she has an apartment in one of these nice retirement communities, as does he. They haven't lost any mental capacity. They have aches and pains, but otherwise they're fine. This is an absolute love match. They hold hands. They look at each other. They are so happy. And this is, you know, so many people just say, oh, well, I'll be dead by 85. No,
no,
you might be married by 85.
You know, I promised that I was going to ask about bonds. You wrote on your website about why you're holding bond mutual funds these days. You say on the surface it may not seem like a wise investment, but you've got good reasons for keeping them. With less than a minute to go, can you give us one or two?
One reason is that I am not going to put all of my money into stocks. I have some, but not all. I'm certainly not going to put it all into the bank at minus 1%. And when you are a long-term holder of a bond mutual fund, as I am, as interest rates go up, the bond value goes down, the market value goes down, but you have to remember that your manager is buying all these new bonds that are coming out at higher rates of interest. And that means that your bond fund is going to be able to deliver higher and higher income to you. And if you are interested in the income from your bond fund, you're going to get more income. And the longer you hold it, if you hold it, you know, 4 years, 5 years, 7 years, depends on the fund, anything that you lose, rates go up, market values go down, what you lose there, you are going to make up in having higher interest payments. And if you are reinvesting those interest payments, as I am, you might be even in 4 or 5 years. And bonds never have they don't swing as much as stocks do.
We'll send people to your website for more information. Thank you so much for being with us.
Always a pleasure, Joy.
Jane Bryant Quinn. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.